We're going to finish up Mark chapter 4 today, and Lord willing, we'll move on to chapter 5. Mark chapter 4. We ended last week talking about the parables of Jesus here that are recorded in Mark. There aren't very many, but there are a few. And they are recorded, most of them recorded here in Mark chapter 4. And it says in verse 33, "And with many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. But without a parable, he did not speak to them. And when they were alone, he explained all things to his disciples." So he then explained things to his disciples. And then it says on the same day, something else is about to happen. We're about to make a shift from his parables, from his teachings, to questions on his identity, who he is. And that will cover through now, chapter 4, verse 35, up until chapter 6, verse 6. And it starts out, this first event that occurs here at the end of chapter 4, the very last verse of chapter 4. Who is this? Who can do these things? And so we will concern ourselves with his identity as well. In fact, Mark had already talked about his identity in Mark, in the very first verse, that this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. He is the Son of God. And so he already identifies himself there. So we're going to look at his identity. If you will, let's read chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. Whoever's got that, please read.
On the same day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" And they feared him exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be, that even the wind and the sea obey him?"
All right. So, starting off, it says that he is about to go on the other side. He wants to cross over to the other side. Now we see in chapter 5 and verse 1 where that is. And in chapter 5 and verse 1 it says, they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gadarenes. But then the question is that what it really says? but we'll talk more about that when we get to that story in chapter 5. But we note that in different passages it could refer to Gadara, it could refer to Gergesa or Gerasa. And so we'll talk again more about those different variants there in chapter 5 and verse 1. But suffice it to say that we have these two possibilities. Gadara is actually right here. But Gadara has a harbor that's right here on the sea. And then there's Gergesa, which is right there. That's important for the next story concerning the demoniac that's mentioned there in Mark chapter 5. Whatever the case, they're going across the sea, and the events that are about to occur are somewhere along this path. It could be, if they're headed to Gergesa, it's somewhere around here. But some evidence suggests it's more likely through here, the center part of the sea, going straight to the other side. Particularly since Mark chapter 5, a lot of the things, there's some evidence of some of the things that are talked about there over here. So it's very likely towards this end. So they're going straight through the center of the sea. whichever one it is, again, the other side suggests that, of course. If you want to, if you say you're going to the other side, chances are you're not going to go right there. You'll probably go down here. So that's likely where he went. At the same time, other little boats were with him, suggesting that not only the 12 were with him, but perhaps the others that were mentioned in chapter 4 and verse 10, where it says that other people were asking him, others with the disciples were asking him questions. And then later in verse 34, he explained all things to his disciples. That's not limited to the 12 necessarily. That could be limited, or that could be expanded to those who were with him. Perhaps the 70 that are talked about in Luke chapter 10, and perhaps more. Who knows how many exactly he had who were his followers? Doesn't say exactly at this point. So other boats were with him during this time. A storm happens. Now, Mount Hermon is perhaps, well, is the tallest mountain in the region. And it's up here somewhere. And what kind of air do you suppose? Is it cold air or warm air on the top of a mountain? It's cool air, right? Very cool air. And it's, in fact, if you see pictures of it, then you see that it's snow-covered very often. So it's a mountain that's that high that it's very often snow-covered. So it's got warm, it's got cool air up there. What kind of air do you suppose is on the Sea of Galilee? Warm or cool air? Warm air. And so what happens when the cool air comes down from the mountain? Pardon?
They collide,
and you get a storm, right? You get a low-pressure system, right? And you get a storm that comes up there. And so this is kind of a regular occurrence that happens. But fishermen, I suppose, at least here, fishermen are typically closer to the shore, and so maybe they're not quite used to going all the way across. So they're not used to having this huge storm that they're dealing with. And so they're scared. Would you be scared in a storm like this? Yeah, you're in the middle of the middle. This is a huge lake. It's more of a lake than a sea, but we call it the Sea of Galilee. It's a huge lake, and you're in the middle of it. What's going to happen? What is going to happen?
Stephen, where did you say Hermon was?
Mount Hermon is to the north, up this way, somewhere.
If they're going, if you think about the storm front coming down, and they're going the full length of the lake, that gives a lot of time for waves to build up. If there's air coming down, the longer rushing air is over the water, the bigger the waves get. And so they could definitely have some pretty tall waves by the time they were down there.
Yeah. And the thing about the there are also mountains off over here. Mount Tabor is over in this direction, so there could be warm air coming from there too. Luke suggests that a storm came down. And suggests that this is the cool air from the top of a mountain or from near the top of a mountain coming down to the warm air here and creating this perfect storm, if you will.
Approximately how far is that from where they embarked to where their destination, you know?
But I'm not exactly sure the scale of the Sea of Galilee. I know it's not a very large lake, but it's... hold on. It's about... Here is. I do have another map a little later on that suggests that from here to here, from Gergesa to the harbor of Gadara, is about 8 miles.
So that would be about a 2 to 3 hour crossing.
And they're in sailboats. Right, they're not. They don't have any kind of motorboat. Pardon?
Yeah, they're sailing.
Yeah.
And another thing too, with the direction that the storm is coming from and the direction that they are going, the wind is blowing the waves behind them, which makes it very unstable in sailing vessel. That's even more scary.
Yeah.
And that's why they'd be getting water.
Yeah. So my question on here, which I kind of already asked, but would you be afraid if you were on a small fishing boat filling with water in such a rough storm?
Yeah.
Yes. Of course you would. I would be afraid. But the next question is, what if Jesus were on your boat? I mean, he's sleeping, but if he were on your boat, would you feel that way too?
I might want to wake him also.
We know the end of the story, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And in fact, a little later on, they're like, who is this person who can control the seas and the waves? They didn't expect him to be able to do that. When they asked him for help, very likely they weren't asking him to calm the sea. They were asking him to get up and, you know, man whatever position to help them. Pardon?
Bail the boat out.
Yeah, bail the boat out, because it is filling with water. Bail the boat out, deal with the sail. I don't know what work was needed on the boat, but I'm sure something, an extra hand might have helped. Yeah, exactly. All hands on deck. One nice touch that Mark mentions here shows that this is an eyewitness account. What was Jesus sleeping on in verse 38? He was sleeping on a pillow. This could be translated as a cushion, something that was making him a little bit more comfortable there on the boat. That is a detail that is not found elsewhere. It's not found in Matthew or Luke. It is only found here, and it shows that this is an eyewitness account. Hey, he was on a pillow. And it's one of those things, whenever you're telling a story and you are an eyewitness, you might randomly put in a detail here or there and not even think about it. Because you were there and you know what happened. But if you weren't there, then you'll just be regurgitating what other people told you. And so that's another nice detail here. Again, Mark himself wasn't there, but it's very likely that Peter was talking to Mark about these things, and this is Peter's eyewitness account. All right, and it also indicates that this was a very deep sleep. How do we know it was a deep sleep?
The conditions that he was sleeping in.
The conditions that he was sleeping in, exactly. There's a huge storm, and yet he was still able to sleep. So then the question is, how could Jesus sleep at a time like this?
He's not afraid.
He's not afraid.
He couldn't dream.
Well, he didn't. He fell asleep before the storm came. So how could he sleep?
You're tired enough, you'll sleep through anything.
The boat could be rocked. It'd be like rocking him to sleep.
Well, it's more like a jostle.
Yeah.
So I have two reasons why he was able to sleep so well. One, he's clearly and completely exhausted. Let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 12. What does Ecclesiastes 5:12 say?
Sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep.
All right. The sleep of, what does it say? The sleep of a
laboring
man is sweet. Have you ever had a really hard day at work and you just fell asleep and you were exhausted and you were out? Nothing can get you up. That's what Jesus is dealing with right now. And you're wondering, well, he wasn't working that hard, was he? He was just teaching people. That's what he was doing. Well, whoever says that teaching is not a real profession, they don't know what they're talking about. Yes.
The other thing is the constant stress of people constantly thronging and begging him for things, hollering, you know. He's in crowds all the time. That just exhausts you by itself.
Well, and before that, he was on a boat on the sea talking to the crowds, teaching. But he was also teaching his disciples at the same time. And so he's dealing with the crowds. He's teaching. If you're a school teacher, you're dealing with a bunch of bratty kids. And except for your kids were wonderful. dealing with a bunch of kids, and not all of them are very well behaved, and trying to deal with that and trying to get a control of a classroom of 30 or 40 people, that's not easy. That is very difficult.
I expect that behavior is contagious, too, to the rest of the crowd. So even the well-behaved ones can be sucked in.
Exactly, exactly. So one or two kids are acting up, and then that kind of behavior spreads. That's exactly right. So, yes?
When Alton was starting to school, when he went to kindergarten, I don't know why they were asking him, but they were asking them what their parents did. And he said, "My daddy works hard on the bulldozer. My mama don't work. She's a teacher."
Oh. Oh. Well.
That's perception.
Yeah.
I lived with a preacher, and nobody was like at the end of the Sunday.
Yeah, it certainly is an exhausting day of preaching and everything.
I just wanted to say he was a teacher first, and a magician. That's not the right word, I know, but
healer, maybe.
He could perform miracles. Second.
Right.
That was a secondary thing. The miracles. He was a teacher first.
Right. And that's exactly right. That was his purpose, right? His purpose, it says, was to preach the gospel, preach the word. And he was doing so at this point through parables. And that was one of his primary goals, not to perform miracles. His miracles were merely to confirm what he was teaching. That's right. So, Victoria?
It makes me think of two things. It's when Jesus healed the woman with the issue of blood, he felt the power go out from him. Huh. So after a full day or days of healing, he's probably literally drained. Hmm. Just emotionally from healing all of those people and feeling that compassion for them and just the overwhelming emotions he would have for them. But also I think of as a mom, after a day of being out-touched, tired of being touched by little hands. When you have that many people around you all the time, I'm sure he was just mentally exhausted from dealing with all of those.
So he was definitely very tired. And that was certainly the case here. And the evidence, of course, is he's a deep sleep. He's in a deep sleep on a boat during a storm, and not a small storm, this is a big storm. And then, somebody have, I have it up here, Proverbs 3, verses 21 through 26. There's another mention of sleep there.
My son, let them depart from your eyes, keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck, and you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down, and your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror or the trouble from the wicked when it comes. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught.
So why is this person that is being talked about, why is he not afraid?
His faith in the Lord.
His faith in the Lord. He's wise. He is using that wisdom. And that wisdom is, if you are constantly afraid about something, then perhaps you're not considering all the angles and trying to get everything situated just right, but you have that wisdom to make sure that things are handled, things are taken care of, and so you're not afraid, and that wisdom, of course, it says at the very beginning of Proverbs that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and so he has a fear of the Lord, he's wise, he's wiser than even Solomon. And he has a clear conscience. If you can sleep, well, if you have a clear conscience, your sleep is much sweeter. Yes?
So the scriptures later tell us in the New Testament that by him and through him were all things created. Right? So here is the part of the Godhead who is actively involved in creation, who created the seas and the planets and the stars and everything else. A wave is not going to bother it. it's just like, yeah, I know waves. Yeah, sure, I made them. but the other part was, I was sitting there thinking, so do we have any examples of Jesus ever showing fear? The only thing I can come up with, not so much fear, but dread, would be the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yeah.
But you don't ever see Jesus saying, oh my, we need to leave. You know, we're in danger, danger. You know, let's go do something. He just walked right into a situation, walked right out. Did that several times, even when they were trying to kill him.
Yeah. It never mentions specifically that he had fear, although there are some scary situations that he was in. There were several times when he was nearly killed, but he was able to move through the crowds. Some might suggest it was miraculously. Some, you know, he could have just found a way to hide and move through the crowds without a miracle having been performed. So he still, and that could have been a very scary time. And maybe he was scared, but it doesn't say specifically that he was. So, but yeah, you're right. The only specific time that I can think of is the Garden of Gethsemane, where he might have had some kind of, it could have been fear, or it could have just been, you know, just sadness, not necessarily fear, but as you say, dread,
trying to deal with what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Not only dealing with that situation of what was coming, but also the fact that he knew how much he had accomplished by teaching, and he was no longer going to be there himself. So he was leaving it in their hands.
Yeah. That's right. Frank?
I'm going to make a statement, but I better ask a question. Did he know all his life that he was going to be crucified at that time and
I don't know about all his life, but I think during his ministry, he certainly knew that.
Yeah, he was giving hints for a couple of years before it happened, so he knew that much. But we don't know about his younger life. We don't have anything recorded.
Yeah. He may have, by the time he was 12, when he was discussing with the people, the priests and teachers in the temple, he might have figured it out by then. But he at least, we know he knew it at least by the time he began his ministry. And Mary might have told him too a couple times for this, you know, what the angel had told him, told her about what was going to happen. And she relayed to Jesus what the angel said in Luke chapter 1 about who he was.
Knowing that might keep me awake more than a stormy boat ride.
Well, but he knew what was coming after.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's go on. So they woke Jesus up. Teacher, don't you care that we're dying? Don't you care that we're dying? They certainly were fearful. And again, fear is only natural in a situation like this. But consider what miracles they had witnessed thus far. Yet they still feared. Remember, this is a bit of a review considering all the miracles that he had performed up to this point. And only the ones so far recorded in Mark. Who knows what else he performed. Exorcisms, healings, cleansing of lepers, more healings and healings, and forgiving of sins. And there's plenty of evidence that he was the Christ. He calls himself the Son of Man several times. The demons, whenever they were cast out, they would always say, "You are the Most Holy One. You are the Son of God." They would identify who he was. Not only that, but at his baptism, which we know at least Andrew was there, at his baptism, we see that the Lord himself, God himself, the Father, identifies him. So, all of that, many saw Jesus baptized and heard the heavenly confirmation, they've seen demons cast out, lepers cleansed, and many people healed. All the people up here that are talked about are just the specific instances. How many times do we read about he healed so many people? He cleansed so many lepers, cast out so many demons. We read about different passages that kind of just mention that and kind of gloss over all those others because they're very similar to what he's already done. At the same time, he could also hear men's thoughts and even forgive sins. And yet all this time, they still are afraid. They still don't quite know who they're dealing with. And then all Jesus had to say was three words, at least three words in English. There are two words in Greek, and I have them up on the board. You probably can't read that, but that is okay. I just wanted to have those two words up there. Siopa pephimosa. Peace, be still. That's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. The language here indicates that the calm was very sudden, not diminishing as a storm naturally would, but a sudden calm. And then Jesus contrasts fear with faith. Faith is bold and fearless. Faith allowed the early martyrs to face their deaths without fear. Now we see in Philippians chapter 1, verse 21, Paul says, and I quote this often, to live as Christ, to die is
gain.
To die is gain. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 18. These are the last written words of the Apostle Paul. And he says, "And the Lord will deliver me from every evil work and preserve me for his heavenly kingdom. To him be glory forever and ever. Amen." He knows he's about to die. In fact, earlier on, he says in verse 6, "I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand." He knew he was about to die. And yet, even then, he says, "The Lord will deliver me from every evil work." He's not talking about physical deliverance. He knows he's about to die. The time of my departure is at hand. What he's talking about is he will be in heaven with the Lord. Yes?
So, I'm 39. The Thompson rebuked the wind. A lot of times we think, you know, what the scripture doesn't often tell us, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, you know, what's the volume of the command, or how harshly was it stated, or, you know, all these kinds of things to kind of let you imagine it a little better. But it says he rebuked it, so, you know, he wasn't just kind of going like, "Hey, man, could you please cut it out?" You know, it's probably more commanding. But what was fascinating is it says, He rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. So what is a great calm? So one, the wind stopped. But there were big waves. The waves stopped.
Yeah.
So you're talking about not just, wow, that wind was, you know, big. We have blustery days here, right? Where the wind gets all blustery, and then all of a sudden it stops, right? Because you're past that. But here you're out in the middle of the lake with a great storm, with huge waves, that's overlapping the boat, and all of a sudden it's completely calm. I mean, that's manipulating the physics of the world, you know, and it's at a different scale. Everything else he was doing was healing, you know, healing and teaching and things like that that were at kind of a human scale, and all of a sudden he's at a earth physics kind of scale.
Yeah.
You know, doing something completely different. They had lots of prophets who did things, right, who could do things. There were a few prophets who did, you know, didn't calm the sea, but, you know, opened the Red Sea. But all of a sudden, they're at a different level of power. I think that's one of the things that surprises them.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. After this, it says in verse 41 that they feared exceedingly. Now, it says that they were afraid before. Do you think this is the same kind of fear?
It's more of a respect.
Yeah, a respect. A reverential awe. This question, oh, he just did that? Whoa, okay. He's much more than we thought he was.
I think he's so associated with fear because you have such a reverential awe, as you said, that you want to be very careful what you do around him and pay attention and do the right thing.
That's right.
Otherwise, he might do something to you.
And we'll see a little bit later in chapter 5, I'll probably get to that next week, where the people, they want him to leave because of what he had done. And they were afraid of him. And this was a different kind of fear. But anyway, then they asked this question of one another. Who is this? Who is this? We already talked about this a little bit, but the voice from heaven had already confirmed his identity. The demons had already affirmed it many times, though he tried to silence them, and in many instances he may have been successful, but they still got a few words out. Some of them did. No one else had done miracles in over 400 years. Don't know exactly if Malachi, the last prophet before John the Baptist, we know John the Baptist didn't perform any miracles because it says so, but before John the Baptist, the last prophet was Malachi. Don't know, aside from inspiration, don't know what kind of other miracles he might have performed, if any, but he would have been the last one to have. And so there hadn't been any miracles in over 400 years, and especially none to this degree. I mean, as Sam said, the parting the Red Sea would have been just as dramatic as what had just happened. Perhaps the Jordan River separating as well, the walls of Jericho falling down. But this is the sun standing still in the sky. These are amazing miracles. But none of the people alive in Jesus' time saw those. And so that this is a different level that they were not expecting Jesus to be able to perform. And yet here he is. They still question who this can be. Who is this? Who is this? This reminds me, and I have a reference up here, 1 Samuel 17, verse 58 through, or 55 through 58. Do you remember what 1 Samuel 17 is about? Right? David and Goliath. And do you remember what happens at the end of that story of David and Goliath, at the end of chapter 17? Saul is like, who is this guy? Abner, go check this out. Go check out who this guy is. And the funny thing is, and Abner's like, I have no idea who this is. But the funny thing is, David had been Saul's minstrel already. Saul knew David. And it's plain in the previous chapter, in chapter 16, that they knew who each other was, who Saul knew who David was. And yet here, David goes out and does this, and even in chapter 17, he comes up and he tells Saul what he's going to do, and he tries to fit on his armor, Saul's armor, and David's like, no, I don't need this. And then he goes out and kills Goliath. So they know each other. And yet Saul is still like, who is this? This situation here in Mark chapter 4 reminds me of that situation where someone does something great and suddenly you don't know who they are. They do something uncharacteristic, at least in your mind, uncharacteristic of who they are. My wife and I jokingly say whenever, and maybe you do this too, I don't know, we jokingly say if someone does something that we might consider uncharacteristic of the other, like, who are you and what have you done with my husband? What have you done with my wife? So it's that kind of thing. You don't, that's jokingly, obviously, but it's a similar situation where you are, where someone does something that you consider uncharacteristic of that person, and it's, suddenly you don't recognize them anymore. And so that's what you see with Saul and David, and that's what you see with the disciples and Jesus. Who can this be? Surely we've seen all these things happen, but man, this is something greater than we thought. This is something greater than we thought. He can even control the weather. I mean, disease is one thing in their minds, but the weather? That's something else entirely. Jesus, he never came out and told people who he was. He had them figure it out for themselves. Jesus wanted his disciples to be able to figure it out on their own. Yes?
There are times when he says, like he's talking to the woman at the well, right? And she says, well, I know when Messiah comes, he's going to tell us all things. He says, I'm he.
Yep.
I mean, it's not like he doesn't admit or state that he's the Son of God or that he's the Messiah. But as the scripture says, he doesn't go crying it out in the street. he doesn't try to raise a crowd by saying, come listen to the Son of God, I'm the Son of God, you know. He doesn't do that kind of thing. It's very humble and meek.
Yeah.
And can you imagine, because, you know, the boat gets to shore. There's a lot of boats, right? There's a bunch of little boats. There's a bunch of people see this. They're all going around going, what in the world happened? They're telling everybody. When people start hearing that, this starts building toward the same thing happens after the feeding of the people, and they say they want to make him king by force. You know, the rumor mill starts going that this guy, not only can he heal, but he can also control the weather. We saw him shut down a storm and calm the whole sea. You know, he's a superpowered person, and that's why they started doing that. They started thinking he could beat the Romans, he could restore Israel, he could do whatever.
And you're right. He doesn't tell people outright, but he doesn't deny it either. And he does say earlier in Mark chapter 2 that he is the Son of Man. And that's one of the designations we see in Daniel chapter 7 of the Messiah, of the Christ, of the one who was to come. And so he calls himself the Messiah, or he calls himself the Son of Man, which is not not an explicit reference so that people are like, oh, you're calling yourself God, and then they try to kill him. But it is a reference to something that maybe might not have been as well known. And so he refers to himself as the Son of Man. He says, I am the Christ, or I am he. He does say in John, several times he declares that before Abraham was, I am. You know, there are a few times where he does that. And John chapter 8 is the one I'm referencing right there. John chapter 10, I and the Father are one. These are things that are indications of who he is. But again, the disciples are asking, who can this be? This is something kind of new to their experience. Kind of new to their experience here. And he wants people generally, and if he just goes out and tells people who he is, well, that's not, you know, people might not believe him. People will say, oh yeah, he's that guy. People are much more likely to believe him and follow him when they figure it out on their own. When they get little hints here or there, oh, he did say that. Oh, he did say that. And then later on, they put all the pieces together and realize, oh wow, this is the Christ. This is who we've been waiting for. So did somebody, thought I heard? Yeah.
I just thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, the motivation for the calling the crew, the spirit, are afraid of the storm. And then to the point where they wake him up, then he calms the storm, and then he comes after them, which is why he's so afraid. In short, he's, you know, admonishing them, in my opinion.
Right.
So now they're even more afraid. that's when they say, who then is this? Even the wind and sea. So
right.
I think they were just so in awe at this point.
Yeah, that's right.
I think I can see why.
And he says, how is it that you have no faith? All these things have happened. And yet you still don't see. You just still don't recognize who I am. Finally, what do we learn about Jesus from this miracle? We've hinted at it and talked about it a little bit up to this point. But what do we learn about Jesus from this miracle? It says, I have here written down, he is the creator who can control his creation. You know the tale of Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein, the Mary Shelley story. Victor can't control his creation, the monster that he created, right? But Jesus can control what he's created. He's created this earth, and he has the power over it and can control it. We see, and Sam referenced this verse earlier, John chapter 1. Verses 1 through 3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word is God. Or the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Nothing that was made without him. He is the Creator. And that's something that we can learn here about Him, and He can control His creation. That is something remarkable that maybe they hadn't considered before, and something that we must consider now. If He can control His creation, He can keep His promises. If He makes a promise, we can trust in Him. All right, that'll do for today.